I mentioned we're going to be speaking about problem gambling this afternoon and a ban on gambling adverts before the time of 9 o'clock in the evening or night, wherever you consider it to be, and outlawing highly addictive gambling machines. That's been recommended by to an Oireachtas committee. It's to tackle the serious gambling problems. And I mentioned it there in the intro. Problem gambling is twice as common in 15 and 16 year olds than it is in adults. I'm joined by the Chief Executive of Extern Problem Gambling. That is Barry Grant. Hi, Barry.
Hi, Ciara. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us. I think a lot of people will be very surprised by the fact that you're more likely to engage in problem gambling or be a problem gambler yourself. I don't know which way you word it, if you're 15 or 16 years of age rather than a fully grown adult.
Yeah, it's a very worrying statistic. It's from the European School Survey in 2019, and it was one of the first times that they'd looked at gambling behaviours among 15 to 16-year-olds across Europe, including Ireland. And when you break down the figures, the problem gambling prevalence rate among that age group, among males in that age group, is more than double that of the adult population. So that's really, really worrying. So, I mean, first off, I mean, gambling under the age of 18 is inherently problematic anyway, because it puts you at higher risk of developing a problem in later life as an adult. But many of these young people, the children in the schools, were already meeting the criteria for problem gambling or gambling addiction. So that's very, very worrying. And there was another study that hasn't been published yet.
Barry, it's quite difficult to hear you. If you wouldn't mind maybe just moving the phone around there to see if we can get a bit of a better reception. How's that?
Yeah, is that any better?
Much better. Much better.
Sorry about that. So there's another study that hasn't been published yet, but we've seen the data on it from third level students again. So the next age group up, majority of the students who were surveyed were, say, 18 to 21. And it was 1 in 10 of the males in that group had a gambling problem. So, like, we're seeing this kind of pipeline of dangerous, addictive, problematic gambling behaviours coming up, particularly in men. But we, you know, certainly in our service, we're seeing more and more women and young women coming forward as well.
3,400 teenagers between 15 and 16 were identified as engaging in problem gambling. We know that the former Justice Minister, that is Senator Michael McDowell, he's a member of that Oireachtas Justice Committee, who heard these recommendations yesterday. And he said that the changes should be put in place. And the government's long-awaited legislation to regulate gambling did not go far enough. Do you have the same feelings on it, Barry?
I think it's quite robust. I mean, I think Senator McDowell just has concerns about gambling at all. I would share some of those concerns, but I suppose from our perspective, we're not trying to prohibit anything. We just want to make sure that there are robust safeguards and regulations and enforcement of those regulations, which currently we don't have. But there are some very, very good suggestions, both in the original bill and from the Justice Committee. You know, one of those would be, as you mentioned earlier, the pre-watershed ban on all forms of gambling advertising. We would fully support that. I mean,
gambling. Does that really make much of a difference nowadays with, you know, access to phones and stuff like that? And, like, you know, your iPad or whatever. Would you know, the advertisements on TV really make that much of a difference?
Well, it's not just for TV. So, I mean, what they're proposing is a ban, a pre-watershed ban on all forms of gambling on all media platforms. So it'd be TV, radio, social media, and everything else. And I think the biggest one is social media, because that's where the gambling industry and all companies get the most bang for their buck from advertising, because they can target it at specific individuals and specific groups. So again, if you're young, you're male, you're interested in sport, the online tracking algorithms, you know, that we're feeding all of the tech companies all of this free information all of the time, they can say, well, look, if I put a certain amount of gambling advertising in front of this person, there's a much better chance that they're going to click on it or sign up for an account than if I just broadcast it to the whole population. So really, it's really, really important that the focus has to be primarily on social media, because that's where most of the marketing spend for gambling is. And that's where most of us see, probably see most of our ads as well. And I don't think it's beyond the wit of the tech companies to put a timer or a time limit on when certain ads would appear in a certain country.
So you're the chief executive of Extern Problem Gambling, and I know you're a counsellor yourself. And from your experience, why do you think men are more likely to suffer with problem gambling?
Well, generally speaking, males, and I suppose in particular young males, say under 25, would be more impulsive, more likely to take risks. And that would certainly set a lot of people up, especially young males, for something like gambling, because it's inherently risky. You know, for people who become addicted to gambling, the risk is the reward. So it stops being about winning money fairly quickly, and they just get hooked on the buzz of taking the risk of, you know, will I or won't I win the bet? Or will I or won't I be able to pay the bills this week or this month? That becomes the buzz for a lot of people. So certainly, you know, that impulsivity that comes with, you know, being in a certain age, our brains, as a male, you know, our brains aren't fully developed until the late 20s. And that the last part of the brain to develop is the part that controls impulses and decision making. So they would be the most at risk group.
So, right, you're noting there, would say, when it comes to bills, you're getting some sort of a kick out of the, oh, will I, won't I be able to meet these obligations by the end of the month or whenever it is that you need to pay it. What can a person swap that out for in their life?
Well, it's very difficult to find a direct swap, and okay, I suppose that's one of the challenges for people in recovery, and it probably wouldn't be very healthy either. So when people are in early stage recovery, they usually miss the roller coaster ride and the drama and the chaos that goes with being in active addiction, actively gambling on a regular basis. If you were to kind of swap that out for, you know, a healthier version, I don't know what that looks like. You know, do you want to have healthy drama and healthy chaos in your life every day? Probably not, or even if there is such a thing. So, but for a lot of people, maybe they go back to old hobbies and interests, or they kind of look to develop new hobbies and interests and activities. Maybe they actually start spending more quality time with family and friends. It's different things for different people, but to find a straight swap is very difficult, and I probably wouldn't recommend it, even if it were possible.
Okay, okay. Yeah, no, I'm just asking. Nobody take my advice. I'm nowhere near counsellor status, obviously, at all, Barry. You have heard yesterday that Gardaí did arrest 10 men. They have released a further 4 of the 5 men who are being questioned. That was this morning, the news. This is about alleged match fixing in the League of Ireland. So, as I said, 10 were originally arrested yesterday during a day of action for Operation Brookweed, and it also involved searches in Cork, Limerick and Dublin. So the 5 who were detained were former League of Ireland players, and 2 are current. 5 of them were released from custody last night, and obviously the Gardaí confirming this morning that a further 4 were released without charge, but a file was being prepared for the DPP. So at about 8:30, 9 o'clock this morning, one man was still being questioned about the match fixing allegations. We spoke about this yesterday when I gave you a buzz to see if you could come on. This is in itself gambling.
Well, it has to be driven by gambling, because the only reason to engage in match fixing is to set up a situation where a person can make a bet where they can guarantee the outcome of the bet. Like, that's the purpose of any kind of match fixing. And I suppose because there are so many different markets, say, within a football game, I mean, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you could just bet if a team was going to win or lose, or if there was going to be a draw between the two teams, was your kind of standard bet. But now you can bet on the number of corners being maybe over 10 or under 10. You can
really
bet on the number of...
I can go into like a betting shop and bet on that for a match.
That's a huge market.
No,
that's one
way
of the most popular markets among people that
wow,
we work with, is the over-under on corners, right? So you don't have to throw the game to fix a match in a betting ring, right? You just have to give away more corners, right? And that's not you kind of throwing the game or kind of giving away a goal or giving away a penalty to make sure that your team loses. You could still, you know, try hard, play well, and still rig a market within that game, if that makes sense.
It does. I'm so surprised. I'm so naive to it, and I'm very surprised hearing about it. But look, it's a massive problem, as we know, within our communities. Particularly, we've heard a lot of GAA players in the past 10 years who lived with gambling addictions. And, the stories they told in the books they wrote, it's absolutely horrific. And yourself, Chief Executive of Extern Problem Gambling, you obviously want to make sure that people get in touch if they do need help. And to let people know, if you want to speak to Extern in confidence, they are open Monday to Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. You can email info@problemgambling.ie. Or you can text here in the Republic 089 241 5401. And Barry, if there was one bit of advice you'd give to somebody who may be suffering with problem gambling to reach out and help and acknowledge that they have an issue, what would you say?
Talk to someone. It doesn't have to be us. It could be a friend. It could be your spouse or partner. It could be a sibling or a parent. But tell someone, because I've worked with so many people at this stage, and the relief that people experience when they share what's going on with another person, they unburden themselves of that. The trap with gambling is that everybody thinks they can gamble their way out of the financial problem that they've gambled themselves into. That just is not going to happen, right? So if you're chasing your losses, if things are spiraling out of control, just talk to someone. It could be us, any of the other services, ideally a friend or family member who's in your day-to-day life, and just start that process.
Thank you for coming on this afternoon. That is Barry Grant. He is Chief Executive of Extern Problem Gambling. And again, I just want to give you some useful links. Gamblers Anonymous, the number there is 01 Dublin number 872-1133. Extern Problem Gambling 089-241-5401. And you can email info@problemgambling.ie. And any advice is available from them there. There's also HelpLink, Gambling Problem Counselling Service. That's 0818-998-880. Okay, so this summer we're all very, very excited to get back to the beaches and the sea of the countries on the continent. And Spain is always a very popular place for Irish tourists to visit. But they're being warned of heatwave conditions in the country. Just a few days ago, it reached 39 degrees Celsius. Obviously, we're mid-May. Most of us haven't been in the sun for 2 years. So some people are noting that it's going to be a shock to the system. And one of those noting that is Ardcloch resident and travel and aviation journalist Owen Curry. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. It's not 39 degrees yet in Ardcloch, but we're working on it today.
Yeah, it's definitely not 39 degrees here in Naas either. But it's pretty crazy, because I was reading the other day, Owen, I know this is further afield, but in India, the temperature was reaching, in Delhi, I believe, 49 degrees Celsius. So are we to expect overall for Europe a very hot summer?
Yeah, very different dynamic for India. This is when it does soar in India, and there's very heavy humidity. You get this amazing thunderstorms, and I've hit 49 degrees in India myself. It's not for the weak-hearted. A couple of things are going on here. We've seen heat waves like this before. Seven of the hottest years in European travel have been since 2000. Some listeners will remember 2003 with a very high mortality rate for that particular heat wave. We had a very big one in 2021 and one in 2019. But we haven't seen this in May. This, when the records go back to the 1500s, we haven't seen anything like this happening as early in the season. Now, when it hits early in the season...
So literally, are you saying never since the 1500s have we seen this?
Since the 1500s, it was a big deal in 2019 when we had the hottest days in June in about eight different European countries. And that was June, this is May. We still haven't hit June yet. So it's coming early in the cycle. It's a big drama because earlier in the cycle causes higher mortality. The guys who process this data would say that. But
I'm assuming that's because people aren't expecting it. They're not as prepared.
It hits it when they're not prepared, and it hits them when probably things like tolerance and all of that. Now, that's not a tourism issue. That's a local health authority issue. What happens with tourists is they generally stay out of the sun. Very simple advice. There's only two things you do. You hydrate and you put on the maximum sunblock or stay out of the sun altogether. Everyone I know at the health dermatological end of things say cover up. So a lot of them say don't even wear short sleeves, just cover up in the sun and stay out of it. So it's fairly easy for tourists, but it does create a problem for health. And as you say, inland, all of that Andalusia region, that great playground that Irish people love to go, is going to be very hot. It already started the last 2 days. We had, we're expecting it to peak around Saturday, and we've been looking around the Cordoba region, probably 40 or 41 degrees. Wow. Inland. Cordoba, beautiful city, but the real playground for the Irish is on the coast. It'd be around 35 degrees there. Nerja, Benalmádena, Frihiliana, where Christy Moore goes on his holidays, those places, and the Balearic Islands, which are a big playground for the Irish, around 35 degrees as well.
Yeah, so it's noted here, the mercury is expected to rise over 40 degrees. You just said it there this weekend. Usually,
yeah, the 40 degrees of the headline tends to be inland, and it tends to be,
well, obviously,
be around,
coast is
yeah,
going to
be around Cordoba and Sevilla. People will have watched the Europa League final last night. The players were under pressure,
yeah,
because it's already in the high 30s there.
And that was evening time, night time, basically.
Yeah, this evening, yeah.
Usually, just to let people know, at this time of year, it's about 30 degrees or about 28 degrees. So a massive jump there. You know, we're hearing more and more.
And the maximum record for Ireland ever was in Boorabog in County Offaly, and it was 33 degrees. That's the highest we've ever had in Ireland. So you're adding 8 degrees onto that for your trip to Spain. No reason not to go, by the way. Just a reason not to be sitting up
Well, Owen, obviously we had a great summer 2020 weather-wise. It was absolutely lovely. But a lot of us won't have experienced that heat over the past 2 years. So I know you're saying, you know, the advice is to hydrate and, you know, is not that not to go. I do totally appreciate that the tourism industry wants to get back properly up and running. But this may turn some people off, because I have been in 40 degree heat and I can barely cope.
It's basically down to what your environment in is, what access you have to air conditioning. Everybody in, that's out for lunches and things like that are in air conditioned comfort, and it's just grading your day according to early morning versus late evening. A lot of it's an interesting one, because some of the places that Irish people go on holidays have the 40 degrees would not be abnormal. Anyone has done Dubai at this time of year. The other issue is humidity. Humidity is much more uncomfortable. It's called a sun holiday care. It's not a reason not to go on holidays. So, and you won't get much sympathy, I can tell you, if you go to your travel insurance company or your airline saying, I postponed because my sun holiday was going to be too hot.
I am not trying to let anybody say that to anybody. I just want to let people know, though, that Ireland is not going to be affected by the unusual heat. Unfortunately, most of us would say the temperatures are set to remain here in the low to mid-teens.
If you're up in Galicia or in Asturias, where a lot of Irish people go, the Camino is one of the, it's a big, big deal in Ireland.
This time of year as well, isn't it? Around May
Your temperature is 20 to 22 degrees. If you're up in Bilbao, if you're up in the Basque region, if you're up even in Barcelona, the Costa Dorada, it's 2022. It's down, it's absolutely confined to that Andalusia province. And the eastern side of the Andalusia province is where a lot of the really high temperatures are going to be. You're looking at 35 degrees, which, even though it's more than the maximum ever in Ireland, it's much more manageable for Irish people. We do chase our sun at this time of the year.
We do, at all times of the year, Owen Curry. Thank you so much for joining me this
Always
afternoon.
Always a great pleasure, Ciara.
Thank you, Owen. Take care. And as Owen was noting to people, if you are going, just be aware. Stay hydrated. Make sure you have the SPF. Not only is it going to protect your skin, it's also going to keep you young if you're vain. Obviously, a lot of people do encourage wearing like linen kind of clothing, long sleeve, long trousers, not getting the skin out when it comes to the dermatologist, as Owen also noted. Lovely to speak with Owen again. So those who are going on holidays in that area of Spain, the central south area, you're probably going to be seeing above 40 degrees this weekend. I have Ned O'Hara on the line now. He is the General Secretary for the Irish Postmasters Union. Ned, I appreciate you taking your time out, because I know you're a busy guy since yesterday. How are you?
I'm good, Peter. Thanks again for having me on, because you've been a great supporter of ours and listening to us and listening to our woes.
Well, it's always good to hear from you. Thank you for joining me, Ned. You were at an Oireachtas committee yesterday. You said that the post office network is at a, in quotes, critical juncture. It's in desperate need of governmental support. You're calling for 12 million euro in annual funding. That's needed to prevent these large-scale closures across the country.
Yes, Ciara. And like, I suppose it's a long-running saga in relation to post office being in trouble. But we have been working hard to try and provide a service to the people that use us. We proved our work, we feel, during the pandemic. We were designated an essential service, and we provided service to people when people were restricted to 2 kilometres and 5 kilometres from going for their home. We were there to provide service, provide them with cash and all that type of stuff. We have and did an agreement with Post in 2018 to modernise ourselves, if you like, and that was interrupted by COVID. We reached an agreement with Post that will give us support payments to see us through to the end of this year, but those support payments are stopping. And we got a Grant Thornton report completed in 2020 that said unless the government invested in the network, that the danger is that there will be unrestrained closures. Now, when we say invest, we mean invest. We don't expect money for nothing, but we do feel there are a number of services that we can provide but are currently not available in post offices.
Now, Ned, I'm going to ask maybe a very simplified question here, but in the pandemic, in the midst of it, we're still in it. Obviously, I keep saying that as if it's past tense. Unfortunately, it's not. But during the lockdowns in particular, I'm sure the postal network was very busy. People ordering stuff, people sending stuff to, you know, their friends and family. I know I did it myself. Did you note an increase at all during the lockdown period?
Yeah, we noticed an increase in postage, Ciara, but it was temporary. Once the release came, or the restrictions were lifted, it disappeared almost as quickly, particularly the postage thing. There is still a lot of online shopping done, but that doesn't generally cross post office counters, because if you buy something from Amazon, it's collected from a warehouse, it's delivered, and our only input to that then is if there are returns. So while there are some benefits for us, they are not as wide as you would expect or one would expect. The growth in online shopping doesn't necessarily come across post office counters. And I think the services that we provide, particularly making social welfare payments and savings service and bill payment service and stuff like that, they're the ones that people use. And 1.3 million people a week use us. But I think we can do more, Ciara. And I think that every government service should be available. For instance, the government spends a fortune every year printing forms that become obsolete or become out of date. We could do those, print them or get them completed on an online or an on-time basis, a just-in-time basis, and save all that waste. We can reduce carbon footprint by making services available locally, so you don't have to go to, like, okay, if you're in Nace, but if you're someplace and you want to tax your car, I know you can do it online. But other people want to travel in, want to do stuff in person. And I think government services can and should be made available in post offices. We can identify people. So we could, for instance, in relation to the electoral register, which is supposed to be in a very bad shape. So, for instance, if you wanted to be on the electoral register, you could come to the post office, present your photographic ID and have your identity verified for the electoral register or for any government service.
And something like that, Ned, can you give me like a figure or a percentage of how much that would benefit the postmasters or post offices in general? You know what I'm trying to say?
I think the biggest benefit of that we provide, or the post office network provides, is probably...
No, I'm talking about financially a benefit for you.
I'm going to give you a financial figure. But in many ways, it's unquantifiable. But what we have done, and we asked Grant Thornton independently to verify this, what's the value of the post office network, the social value? And they came up with a figure of at least 344 million and up to 730 million. Now, we just used the 344 million. So, for instance, if we weren't there, the social value to the country to replace it would be in the order of at least 340 million. And what we're looking for is an investment. We're not looking for a handout. We're looking for an investment for the government for a period. The normal business planning cycle of 3 to 5 years and review it. Because we recognise the world is changing. We're the first to recognise it. We see it every day. But we also recognise that there's still a demand for our services. And if we're going to be there and provide the services that we do provide to people, we need to be supported. And that needs to be subject to review. Like, we're open to it being reviewed. But what we want more than anything else here is we want a decision by the government to tell us whether they're going to support us or not going to support us. We don't want to be told maybe they will or maybe they won't. So we want them to say, yes, we have a value, which we've established to be at least $344 million, or no, if they think that we're not worth supporting, please tell us that and we can go and do something else with our lives and plan and do something else.
Okay, I just want to let people know 873 of the 918 branches across this country of post offices are run by self-employed postmasters. That's 95% of the post office being run around the country. It's by self-employed postmasters. Look, I appreciate you taking the time, Ned. You're, of course, General Secretary with the Irish Postmasters Union. They have told TDs and senators at yesterday's Oireachtas committee meeting that €12 million in annual funding is needed to prevent large-scale closures throughout the country. Now, yesterday I was speaking about the living wage. That was with, I believe, Elaine Loughlin, the deputy political editor of the Irish Examiner. And this afternoon, Unite, which is a trade union, is calling for the minimum wage to increase to €12.50. The living wage for Ireland was calculated last year at €12.90. Now, that was pre-a war in on the continent of Europe in Ukraine, as we know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Joining me now, though, to discuss is the regional officer of Unite. That is Gene O'Dowd. Thank you for the time this afternoon, Gene.
Thanks, Ciara, for having me on.
So €12.50, I noted that last year we were told the living wage in this country should be €12.90. Why settle on the €12.50?
Okay, well, look, we looked for the €2 increase because this is based on projected wage growth. Low pay is actually defined by the OECD and the European Commission as two-thirds of the median wage. And just to put that into context, the median wage is if you take workers that are earning the highest amount and workers that are earning the lowest amount in the economy, then the person and people in the middle that's the median. So 50% are earning more and 50% are earning less. So based on that projected wage growth, Unite have urged the Low Pay Commission yesterday to adopt a strategy of rising the minimum wage to 66% of the median earnings over a two-year period. So this would be increasing the national minimum wage, as you've already said, to €2. That'll bring it up to €12.50 for 2023 and again raising it in 2024 to €14.95. And in fact, Germany have already gone off the starting block on this one, where their minimum wage, they're currently talking about rising it this year to 22%. And it's also important to point out that Germany has a much higher social wage. So workers receive higher benefits and services such as childcare, which is heavily subsidised.
Do you see this actually coming into place by 2023? Is this realistic, especially as we know at the moment, you know, cost of living crisis, this living wage? I understand why you're calling for the €12.50 after that explanation, but the living wage was calculated last year and it was before the war in Ukraine, and we know how much it's affecting the whole globe. We heard from the UN today. They're talking about, you know, warning of famines and food shortages throughout the world because obviously a lot of grain, wheat and barley, the majority comes from Ukraine, and obviously with the barricading by the Russian soldiers, the exports aren't being exported. So it's affecting us globally. And it just seems like €12.50 isn't enough.
Well, look, I suppose we're actually looking for it. Like, traditionally, the government will announce in the budget of an increase in October. We're actually looking for that increase to come into effect on the 1st of November this year, not the 1st of January next year. And look, I think the reasons for that are obvious, given the spiralling energy, food costs and the rising inflation. And we have to bear in mind that the increase last year, when that increase was implemented, we weren't in the current economic situation that we are now.
Right.
And I'll just give you an example on that, Ciara. I walked into the supermarket yesterday to pick up something for dinner. And I stood in front of one of the fridges that I'd normally just go in, grab something, and I almost fell over because everything in that fridge had actually doubled in price since this time last year.
Yeah.
So I think it's simply a must. It has to be done.
I think there's going to be a lot of people listening to this and completely agreeing with you and nodding their heads at the radio. But it's not that nobody wants to see an increase, but is that increase really realistically enough? this is the difficulty I feel with asking for an increase at the moment, because it seems in all likelihood an increase is going to be very big indeed for the majority of people to make ends meet.
Yeah, look, I agree, and I understand why people would say that it's not enough of an increase. But we have to base these things on figures. We can't pull figures out of the air. We'd all love more of an increase, but we kind of have to structure it around the projected wage growth at this point in time. And it's what we're asking for now is to build on for next year and the year after to take us up. If we go in and ask for something that's unrealistic, we're not going to be entertained. We need to go in with something that's realistic and fact-based so that it will be given serious consideration.
I think what's the frustration, I hear what you're saying, but I think the frustration for many people is the fact that they feel the big increase, as you noted, as something that the government may see as unrealistic, is really the only realistic way people are going to make ends meet. And we're going in to the winter season still with high inflation when it does come around, and the cost of fuel still very, very high. Obviously, it's an increase is something that everybody needs to see. You are at Unite calling for the minimum wage to increase to $12.50. Last year, the living wage for Ireland was calculated at $12.90, and we know since the war in Ukraine, inflation has continued to rise. I really appreciate your time this afternoon. That is Jean O'Dowd, Regional Officer for Unite Trade Union.